Case on the calendar is Jasmine.
It is, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Did you say three?
Two.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Sean Hicks. I represent Reed Jasmine, the employee plaintiff in this case. When an employer agrees to settle a wage claim and then breaches that agreement, the court must award attorney's fees against the employer for that breach. The trial court below erred when it enforced the wage claim settlement but did not award attorney's fees for that breach. This is a wage claim case. Mr. Jasmine commits an action for unpaid wages, unpaid commissions, unpaid profit share, unpaid employee benefits, unpaid employee reimbursement, and double damages for those claims. 11 days before trial.
The defendants never agreed that's what they were paying for, though, is it?
The defendant agreed they were paying $15,000 to settle a wage claim action. This is the only action the plaintiff
Without
has.
Admitting any liability
right.
or wrongdoing.
That's right. That's sort of like an Alford plea, isn't it? Is it? You know, hey, I'm not admitting I did anything wrong, but that doesn't mean the charges are withdrawn. The
if you're primarily relying on Alford for your reasons,
no, I'm not.
I think you might be.
It's analogous.
Reaching.
It's analogous to that situation because here, when we filed our motion for judgment to enforce it and to ask for attorney's fees, we came forward with a prima facie case saying this is a case for unpaid wages, unpaid commissions, unpaid benefits, and double damages.
Isn't it so that during the negotiations or after the point at which it was determined that you had arrived at a settlement agreement that you, on behalf of your client, asked that it include an attorney fee clause, and that was determined to not be part of the agreement?
That's true.
And so if what you're enforcing is an agreement, which is a form of a contract, and that contract does not have in it a clause saying that prevailing party gets attorney fees, then what would be the authority for inserting an attorney fee element into that contract?
The underlying statute, Your Honor.
And what case has the court done that? And it's been approved, rather than when you go to trial and prevail. Clearly, then you would get attorney fees under the statute.
But. Well, how about Leitz versus Hansen Law Office? In Leitz, there was an offer of judgment. Silent regarding attorney's fees. There's no trial, no findings of fact. Offer of judgment. Agree to pay the plaintiff.
And which case was this?
Leitz, L-E-I-T-Z versus okay. Hansen Law Office. Okay. It was an offer, a CR-68 case. Offer of judgment, offer to accept judgment against the defendant for some amount. Judgment, offer accepted. Nothing stated about attorney's fees. Next motion for attorney's fees. Granted. And the Court of Appeals said it must be granted. It's not because the offer of settlement itself contained an attorney fee clause. It's because it didn't. It's because the underlying statute mandates the award of attorney's fees when an employer breaches. That's what happened here. The statute mandates it. And this employer breached it. Our victory was a Pyrrhic victory.
True.
We go to all this effort 11 days before trial. We settle for $15,000 to pay in 30 days. And then they say, deal's off. You'll go spend $20,000 on attorney's fees to get a $15,000 judgment. Wow, isn't that great? But that was the Pyrrhic victory we had. And when an employer does that, they cheat their employee out of their agreed wage claim settlement, and the underlying statute mandates the award of attorney's fees. You know, what's instructive on this is just last month, our Supreme Court in Allen versus Dameron, on February 2nd, 2017, made a decision. It was a case that came from the Bankruptcy Court, Western District of Washington, comes to the Supreme Court, and the issue was, well, there, the company was going broke, and they couldn't afford to pay their employees, and they filed for bankruptcy. And the question was, can the officers of the company be liable? Was this an intentional act, a willful act to not pay the employees so that the officers of the company are personally liable? The court said yes. personally liable. The willful act. The willful act is they chose to pay insurance premium instead of choosing to pay the employee. These defendants chose not to pay the wage claim settlement. They instead chose to pay other people. The Supreme Court said in footnote 11, the purpose of that statute, which expressly provides for personal recovery against officers, says that as we have noted in several cases, the statute must be liberally construed to advance the legislature's intent to protect the employee wages and assure payment, citing Shillings versus Radio Holdings. In addition, the court said, the wage statutes reflect the legislature's strong policy in favor of payment of wages to employees, citing more cases. In the next footnote, they talked about, well, how much does it take? And the court said, it matters not if it's one day or one month under that statute. The employer claims that under any of these three statutes, that the employee waived their right to recover statutory right to recover attorney's fees because it says there's a waiver of any and all claims. That is not a waiver of a statutory right. That's a waiver of a claim that we now know. We now know on October 8th, we now know that there's $22,000 at issue for the wage claim and attorney's fees thereon. We're going to settle all the sins of the past, so to speak, for this one nut, $15,000. We didn't waive a prospective breach because it hadn't happened yet. We didn't waive a statutory right. It doesn't say a waiver of a statutory right. It only says a waiver of a claim. These were the terms that the employer mandated. However they're interpreted, against the employer, not against the employee. And if it had said it's a waiver of a statutory right, that waiver would have been void as against public policy. You cannot make an employee waive a statutory right. You can have them waive a dollar amount for a claim arising out of it, but you can't waive a statutory right. The trial court also should have awarded judgment against the license bond. We got a judgment against the employer for $15,000. I asked for a judgment against the bond because it's a labor claim. The judge denied it. I don't have a clue why. But we have a judgment against the employer for labor. The statute follows. We have to have a judgment against the company's bond. It was denied. For that, the trial court also erred. Therefore, we request the trial court's decision be reversed and remanded for the award of attorney's fees below and here in this court, pursuant to 18.1, for attorney's fees in this proceeding. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Cecilia Cordova, and I am the attorney for the respondents. This case is about whether or not a plaintiff may obtain remedies that he had earlier waived in a CR2A agreement. And this court should affirm the trial court's decision below because first, he succeeded at enforcing the CR2A agreement by arguing that he had waived any and all claims known and unknown. And second, under the doctrine of judicial estoppel, the court should accept as true the appellant's original argument that he had waived any and all claims known or unknown pursuant to the CR2A agreement. The facts are in the record under Clerk's Papers 265 and the appellant's motion to enforce the CR2A. He argued that he had accepted the employer's offer to settle by waiving any and all claims known or unknown. And then in the clerk's papers 342 to 343, in the appellant's motion for judgment on the CR2A, appellant again argued that he had accepted the settlement proposal of waiving all claims known and unknown. Again, in the clerk's papers 375 to 376, in the appellant's opposition to the motion for reconsideration, the appellant argued that he had accepted twice the employer's settlement offer to waive any and all claims, known or unknown. And in addition, in the clerk's papers in 375 to 376, the appellant had...
Is that how you're distinguishing the Leach case, or is there another way to distinguish that?
No, the Leach case was actually in the Leach case, the court stated that in the CR 68, it was an offer for judgment. Mm-hmm. And in the offer for judgment, the courts have actually distinguished offers for judgment as opposed to settlement claims for any and all claims. In the McGuire case, McGuire v. Bates, the Washington Supreme Court ruled that there's only one reasonable meaning that can be ascribed to the words to settle all claims, and that's that all claims encompasses all claims, including claims for settlement. It's important to note that in the clerk's papers 2-3, in which is the appellant's complaint, that there were two statutory wage claims, and in it explicitly states not only that the appellant was making statutory wage claims, but that he was also asking for statutory for attorney's fees that were allowed.
What case are you talking about right now?
Oh, actually, I'm citing to the record in the clerk's papers 2-3, and because these were claims that he was making, what I'm saying is, the point I'm making is that when the appellant agreed to waive any in all claims, that because he had asked for statutory attorney's fees, then that would include the statutory attorney's fees under the wage claims. In addition, in clerk's papers, I believe it's number 3, he had also asked under RCW 18.27 for a judgment against the statutory bond, which was also waived in the CR2A, and which, again, the appellant is asking the court to enforce, but which was a remedy that he had waived in the CR2A agreement.
So that's your response to his argument?
For the leads. Well,
the bond.
Exactly, for both the statutory attorney's fees and for the bond, because they were both within the complaint. Those were claims that were known. They were explicit in the complaint. And when he agreed in the settlement agreement, the CR2A, to waive any and all claims, it was appropriate for the respondent to believe that those claims were being waived. Did that answer your question?
What are the facts of that case? Does counsel accurately say that what happened was that there was a CR offer of judgment and the other party accepted it, and then the court was obliged to award attorney's fees even though the author of judgment did not mention it? Is that correct?
As I recall in the Leitz v. Hansen case, I believe Mr. Leitz was a paralegal, and he also acted as a private investigator for the Hansen law firm and for Ms. Hansen, and he was later terminated. He filed for a breach of contract, later on, Ms. Hansen offered an offer in judgment. I believe that it was originally, and I may be wrong, but I believe that it was initially rejected, but what happened at the end was that there was an offer in judgment, which is a CR 68, which is distinguished by the courts from a CR2A or a settlement of all claims, and the courts have distinguished between those.
Well, they've distinguished them, but have they, on what basis? I mean, in other words, in what basis that is material to the issue here? Are they saying that do they come right out and say that whereas CR 68 is one thing and CR2A is another thing, that if you don't put attorney fees in one, you don't get them, but if you don't put them in the other, you do get them?
Exactly.
Which case is that says exactly that?
It would be in the McGuire v. Bates case, which is a Washington Supreme Court case, and the court distinguished between CR 68 offer of judgment, where the judgment was silent on attorney's fees, and the underlying statute or the underlying contract would allow attorney's fees. The court noted that, whereas here there was only the court determined the party's intent by focusing on their objective manifestation as expressed in the contract. And here in the CR2A, the words were very clear. It was a waiver of all claims, any and all claims, known or unknown.
So, I mean, when you say objective manifestations, that's contract language. So are you saying that the distinction is that a settlement agreement is a contract and a CR2A agreement is something else, not a contract?
No, the CR2A is to be interpreted as a contract. The courts interpret the CR2A as a contract.
And a CR68 is not interpreted as a contract?
It's an offer in judgment, and so there's a difference. In the underlying wage statutes, typically attorney's fees are allowed if there's a judgment on wages. We can distinguish this case here because this was a judgment to enforce a CR2A agreement, which is distinguished from an offer in judgment on an underlying wage claim.
So contract principles would apply in this case?
Yes, it would.
Not according in the McGuire-type case?
But in the McGuire-type case, because it was a settlement for all claims, the court looked at it, they interpreted it as a contract, I believe.
Oh, they did. So both of them are contract cases.
Except that the CR68 is an offer in judgment, so it's a judgment on a wage claim. In terms of leets, I apologize for not distinguishing that. I also wanted to, before I run out of time, I wanted to address, I didn't have time to, because I wasn't aware that co-counsel was going to cite to Allen v. Donovan, but it sounds, but he did cite the Schilling v. Radio Holdings case, which I had jotted down that it was very similar to. And in that case, the court determined that financial inability, which sounds like that's what happened with Allen v. Donovan, though I haven't had a chance to brief the case, but in the Schilling v. Radio Holdings case, they went bankrupt and argued that it wasn't willful under the RCW 4952. However, the court held that financial inability is not tantamount or is not equivalent to non-volitional, which the court has held that if it's volitional, then that's willful, and that meets that element of willful and intent to deprive an employee of wages. And here, the judgment for the $15,000 doesn't fit within the definition of wages. While wages are traditionally looked at as compensation for hours performed, for work performed, the courts have also determined that wages can be for compensation as a result of employment, by reason of employment. For instance, in the McGinnity case, which I believe that was cited in the reply brief, the court noted that unpaid vacation benefits were wages within the definition of the wage statutes because it was by reason of employment. They likened it to the, I believe it was a Natchez School District case v. Cruzen, where unpaid sick leave was determined to be wages under the definition of the wage statutes because despite the fact that it wasn't compensation by reason of work performed, it was compensation by reason of employment. But here we've had no citation. I apologize.
You can finish your thought.
Okay. Thank you. If I could, I would just like to ask the court if they can look at the judicial estoppel agreement under Anfinsen, where the court looks at three separate.
Okay, but not.
Okay,
that's beyond finishing your thought.
Okay, and for the foregoing reasons, we respectfully ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision below as correct.
Thank you
very much, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm going to make three points, I think. First one, the counsel says that in the agreement we waive remedies. That's not what it says. It didn't say, the offer that was made, it said we offer to settle all claims. It didn't say waive or settle, waive all remedies. It said we settled all claims. It didn't say we waive remedies. The remedies remained in place. They were not waived. This offer is to be construed against this employer, and liberally so, because this is a wage claim. The second point, against the bond. Today was the first time I've heard that argument. It was not made to the trial court. Today, counsel said that we waived our remedy against the bond. That's not what she said to the trial court. When I made my motion against the bond to the trial court, there was no opposition. Today we have it. But that's not what happened, because we did not waive a remedy against the bond for the non-payment of the of the obligation by the employer. The judgment should have been against the bond.
I'm not quite sure how you have waiver of claims but not remedies. I mean, for example, one of the remedies for a wage claim is damages, isn't it?
Yeah, well, let's just say the employer doesn't pay the $15,000. Does that mean I can't garnish? That's a remedy. Does that mean I can't notify?
Do you now think that if your claim for damages was greater than 15, that you could go back in and say, but actually 15 wasn't all the damages I suffered?
No, I think that was precluded. See, what was precluded was the quantum, the dollar amount that was owed. For all the issues of the past, whatever they are, $40,000 with attorney's fees, it was settled for 15. That's it. That's the quantum. But how do I collect it? Against the bond, against the garnishment, notifying labor and industries. Those are remedies. Those remedies were preserved and not waived. Mr. Reed Jasmine, he submitted an affidavit supporting his wages. There was no evidence to say that his claims were not. The only evidence was, I don't think we owe him a penny. That is not evidence. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Next case is State.